This is our last session on Judaism, and there's a point that I need to go back and pick up from our last talk, and that has to do with the destruction of the temple in the year 70. There are two things that I'd like to mention about this, and they're in anticipation of our coming sessions on Christianity. The prophets had said that the Messiah, when he came, would purify the temple. And that clearly implied that the temple would be there and that he would enter it and he would do this, that, and the other, whatever purify it meant. But with its destruction, it means that those prophecies can't come true any longer. Whoever the Messiah was would have had to come before the year 70. It also has another very significant result concerning the New Testament books, the New Testament canon. There's been a lot of study and a lot of debate over dating the books of the New Testament. And there have been scholars who have speculated that, say, the Gospel of John wasn't written until the year 250 and things like that. But the fact that the temple was destroyed in the year 70 wrecks all those speculations. You see, this was the major tragedy in the history of Judaism. And early Christians were observant Jews who came to believe that Jesus was the Christ, he was the Messiah, and even more than that, the incarnation of God. But they were almost all Jews. And so the destruction of the temple would have been just as significant and just as tragic for them. In fact, for those of them who had become Christians, it would also confirm their Christianity, because they could use that argument that whoever the Messiah was would have had to have come prior to the destruction of the temple. And that Jesus had, in fact, purified the temple. He had thrown the money changers out for cheating people right on the grounds, the sacred grounds of the temple. And the fact is, there is not a whiff of a breath of acknowledgement that the temple has been destroyed in any of the books of the New Testament. Now, let me offer you an analogy to make this point clear. Suppose you picked up a book and it was a history of New York City, and it ended with no account of the attacks on the World Trade Center. What would you suppose about when that book had been written? You'd assume then, you'd believe that that book was written prior to those attacks. That's why the account isn't in there. And the same thing is true here. Since there's no mention of the destruction of the temple in any New Testament book, the conclusion is that they were all written prior to the destruction of the temple. Or it would have at least been mentioned. It would have been used as an argument for the Jews who were Christians against the Jews who remained in Judaism. But there's no such argument made, and no mention of the destruction. That, to my mind, that's an argument that has no rebuttal. There's no comeback. I know that there are a few scholars that have tried to say, well, there are little hints that the temple was destroyed. I find that ridiculous. Little hints that the temple was destroyed? Something that, it's like saying that, well, this book on New York City didn't actually describe the attack on the World Trade Center and didn't say it was destroyed. There are little hints that it might have happened. That's ridiculous. A major event like that could not fail to have major coverage. So I find that to be a powerful argument. And in fact, I think it's a powerful argument for those of us who believe Jesus was the Messiah, that the Messiah was to come to the temple. The temple was destroyed in the year 70, so the Messiah can't come after that. And prior to 70, who of all the people that ever claimed to be Messiah is more likely the Messiah than all the rest? That seems to me perfectly obvious. So I wanted to point this out about the destruction and the significance of the date, and in relation then to our coming lectures on Christianity. We have now to say some things about the development of Judaism since, and I did get to the Middle Ages anyway last time by talking about Maimonides and so on, but in more recent centuries there have been further developments, doctrinal developments among Jews and in Judaism. There are a number of major branches that have emerged in more modern times. Of course, the Orthodox Jews still regard the Torah as prime revelation from God and try to keep the old Jewish practices, the observances, the feast days, the rituals, as strictly as they can, despite the fact that there's no central place of worship in the world. There's no temple where the sacrifices are continued. Those are ended. But at the Orthodox, wherever they are, Europe, the U.S., as well as Israel, want to keep as strictly to the law of Moses as they can. In the 19th century, we have the rise of Reform Judaism. And Reform Judaism meant for these people the primacy of reason, not revelation. They wanted to take over religious practices insofar as they seemed rational and could be justified rationally. And they regarded themselves as curators of Jewish tradition and practice rather than the tradition and practice having been revealed by God and being binding on them. I once invited a Reform rabbi to speak to one of my classes, and one of my colleagues at the college was a conservative Jewish woman. She was happened to walk past the doorway as this man was lecturing, and he was saying, "It's not that we believe all this stuff. God didn't really hand Moses tablets on Mount Sinai, and God didn't part the Red Sea and help the Jews escape and so on. This is all Jewish folklore, and we are curators of Jewish tradition and practice." And she heard that as she was walking by. I was standing next to the door, and she said, "Step out of the way." She said to me, "I'm going to go spit on him." I said, no, please don't. I managed to prevent that, but I want to show you, that illustrates what I want to show you is the attitude of conservative or orthodox toward Reform and Reconstructionist. It's pretty bitter. So that Reform Judaism has come to us from the middle of the 19th century, and of course is one of the branches today. There is also conservative Judaism. Now here's a group of people that react against the Reform. This isn't just folklore and being custodians of a tradition for the sake of, you know, like being museum curators and exhibit all the artifacts that we've collected and protected. No, there's real religious value there. Now, let me read to you what one conservative says. Conservative Judaism had its origin simultaneously in America and Western Europe among those Jews who either in theory or practice could no longer be Orthodox and yet refused to accept what they regarded as the extreme non-traditionalism of Reform Judaism. The first is the assertion of the centrality of religion in Jewish life. The second theme, heavily underscored, is the sense of tradition, of history, of the continuity of Jewish life, both through time and in space. is this feeling of the organic unity of one Jewry with other Jewries, which Professor Solomon Schechter, the leading figure in American conservatism, caught in the phrase Catholic Israel, Catholic in the sense of universal. This phrase is more than a description. It's intended to serve as a norm for the guidance of behavior. That shall be done by Jews, it implies, which is normal by to Catholic Israel, to hold on to the traditional, to sanction modification slowly, reluctantly, and if at all possible, within the framework of Jewish law. So that's a typical conservative attitude. You can see the contrast with the Orthodox and also with the Reform. Since that time, there has been the rise of what is called Reconstructionist Judaism. Leading figure in this movement was Mordecai Kaplan, who died in 1983. This was a movement that arose among conservative Jews, and it tends toward the Reform position. According to this view, there's no personal God, no revelation, no divine intervention. There is no creed for this, no required theological beliefs. It attaches religious feelings to naturalism. It's closely allied with Reform Judaism, but differs in holding that Jewish practice be maintained wherever possible. But they are understood as folkways rather than commands from God. And those are the main branches as they exist today. Of course, there's a lot of variation within them. So just ticking off these four doesn't account for the nuances and the varieties within each and how they relate to one another. This concludes our sessions on Judaism, and I hope that you will do more reading, because we've only been able to scratch the surface. I know I said that about Hinduism and Buddhism, but I have that feeling whenever we reach the end of several lectures and we've covered a huge tradition with such great variation and many subtle differences and nuances of doctrine, and we get done, I've just barely skimmed the surface, but I hope that this will be sufficient to introduce you to the literature, and you will go ahead and do even more reading in the future.